The Vox Markets Podcast. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Welcome back, everyone, to Vox Markets Live. My name is Paul Hill. I'm delighted again to be able to speak to equity analyst and stock markets commentator Paul Scott to discuss all things small caps. So big welcome, Paul.
Thanks, Paul. Hello, everyone.
Yeah, well, another very, very busy week, but that's particularly hot as well with all the football both on and off the pitch. But have you been, amid all the sort of the chaos, have you been buying or selling anything this week?
No, I don't think, I'll just quickly check, I don't think I've done any trades this week, mainly because I haven't got any spare cash. I mean, there's literally dozens of stocks that I would love to buy if I had some spare cash, but there's nothing I particularly want to sell either. So there we are. So I'm kind of static at the moment. How about you, Paul?
No, I haven't either. I think the last ones was Craneware, and I'm still licking my wounds after that.
Same.
20% profit warning, which was a bit painful about a week later.
So,
but anyway, yeah. We've had lots of news this morning. We've got another takeover bid for EasyJet, the low-cost airline. Previously, as people will remember, it's had five bids from Castle Lake, who have been stalking it for the last 2 months. And their top bid, I think, is £6.90, which they put in on Monday.
Right.
Anyway, we've got Apollo Capital or Apollo Management, who also have some investments in other areas of the aviation sector, who have come over the top with a £7.15 per share bid. How do you see this one flying?
Well, it confused the hell out of me this morning. I hadn't had my first coffee, and I'm looking at this and thinking, Apollo? I don't remember that. I thought, weren't they called something else? Castle Lake? And so, yeah, it confused me for a little while. And, I mean, it looks good. So, yeah, they've come in over the top. This is a lovely scenario, isn't it, for EasyJet shareholders, where you have two groups effectively fighting for it. So the question now, of course, look at that. Lovely, isn't it? So that was on my Bonk and Bargain basement bin list as well. With Jet2.com. So they were such screaming obvious buys when the Iran war happened, weren't they? I mean, it always bounces back after. So, no, I mean, this is now holding out the possibility of a back and forth, isn't it? I don't know if Castle Lake will go any higher, but looks great. I mean, £7.15, it's only 3.6% above the Castle Lake figure. So it's not that much higher, but it's been fully agreed in principle by EasyJet's board. And they described it as a, quote, superior outcome to the Castle Lake proposal. Yeah, good for them. Get two competing parties involved and Bob's your uncle.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see whether anybody comes over the top of Apollo.
Yeah.
But I must admit, it looks pretty much a done deal, because the way they've structured it is they've got this alternative or this option whereby you can run your equity into the new investment vehicle.
Yes.
And also they say they will keep the management team in place and the existing royalties. So that smells to me.
Oh, that, yes. Good points.
That Apollo have spoken to Stelios, which is the 15% shareholder, because it allows him to roll into the new vehicle and importantly vote on the board, effectively, you vote his shares, because they're not just going to be rolling in. Because most of the time when you roll into these investment vehicles, they're non-voting shares. They basically strip that out.
And
so this time, because they've given that allowance, suggests to me they've spoken to Stelios, and Stelios is happy with the 7.15. Now, clearly, if somebody like IAG comes over the top at sort of 7.50, then that'll change the game. But I think with you, I think Castle Lake has now got a big ask to go above the Apollo bid, because they've probably wrapped up quite a few of the shareholders.
Yeah, those are really interesting points. And also, of course, with the airlines, you've got this EU ownership rule, haven't you? So for Apollo, that would make sense to get some of the existing European shareholders to roll their positions into the new company. And of course, it would mean they have to lay out less cash as well. So, yeah I mean, it's got the look of a proposal that could well go ahead. Although I think there's a lot of regulatory boxes to tick, isn't there? So I think, you know, if it was me, unfortunately, I don't hold this one. I bought Jet2.com. What I should have done is, because it was a sector buy, I should have just bought IAG, Jet2 and EasyJet in a third position sizes each. So lesson learned from that one, I think. But yeah, I think I'd be inclined to probably bank a bit in the market, maybe sell half. But if I did hold it.
Yeah, well, now you're on the subject of airlines. We've got Simon. He's asking about Jet2, which is your sort of preferred play in the low-cost airlines. It's also got a big package holiday business. And I think it's just invested in a new sort of location down in Gatwick where it's
that's right.
Extra volumes. It needs to buy a whole bunch of new planes as well. But putting it all into the mix, regardless of that, your bargain basin bonkers list has done well. Hasn't it?
I think I'm really pleased with Jet2 because my thesis on this was to ride out the Iran Middle East situation because EasyJet, IAG, and Jet2.com, but just got bulletproof balance sheets, so you didn't have to worry about a thing really. They would get through it. So I looked through that to begin with, and I think it's, you know, in terms of the fuel and the disruption, it's been less than I think everyone expected. But my thesis on Jet2 in particular was British people are not going to forego their short-haul summer holidays. In fact, if anything, it might increase demand because they're not going to go to Dubai probably and maybe don't want to overfly a war zone going on long haul. So that's what I expected. And it didn't look at it. Do you remember one of them? I forget which one. It might have been Wizz Air actually said, at the start of the Iran war, we've been badly hit by.
Yes.
So that made me wobble and think, oh God, have I got this wrong? But I stuck to my line on it. And actually, thankfully, the update from Jet2 was exactly what I was hoping for. They basically said, everyone's leaving it to the last minute, which has been a trend for years now. But they said bookings are now up 7%. Brits still want their summer holidays. There was a very good webinar I listened to yesterday from Jet2.com talking about they don't see the heat wave in the UK affecting bookings at all. People still want to get away with their families in the school holidays, even if they're booking at the last minute. So I thought it was a very, very good update this week. And the shares are donkingly cheap. And it's doing huge buybacks. This is the other thing. You're on if you normalize earnings for taking out the effect of the Iran war in this year, you're probably on a PE of about 6 or 7 with a huge net cash pile of 2 billion, which is a lot of that's customer upfront payments, but a lot of it is the company's own cash. So it can afford to renew its fleet, which you correctly alluded to. They've got all these energy efficient planes on order, which they've got ample funding to cover. And they've just announced a new buyback of 10% of their own shares. I mean, it's stonkingly good value and an amazing long-term track record of a major multi-bagger back from the days when it used to be Dart Group. This business had been built by scratch, and I think it's a phenomenal bargain. So I quite like it, as you might have gathered.
Would anybody buy it?
You've got Meeson, haven't you? The founder, who's still a substantial holder. Mm. So not dissimilar to the Stelios type situation. So yeah. I don't know. I don't know anything about him. So other than that, he's, you know, created an amazing business and still retains a big holding in it. So I suppose it's like anything, Paul, isn't it? If the price is right, who knows?
Yeah. Okay, we've got a general question actually from Drew. He's asking about Cotney Rebel yesterday, apparently mentioned in his weekly post that he's decided to concentrate mainly on the main market shares, not AIM shares, because he feels there's stronger fund flows there and institutional buying. Have you got any thoughts on that at all?
I'm just totally agnostic as to where things are listed. For my purposes, it doesn't matter. So, no, obviously I respect Richard immensely and, you know, he's got a point. But I think we have seen with quite a few shares that have decided to move from AIM to the main market, it's often done the opposite of what they expected, you know, although maybe that is a temporary thing while inheritance relief funds or managed portfolios are selling. But I'm not totally convinced by that point. But, you know, so no, it doesn't matter to me in the slightest whether it's AIM or main.
Yeah, no, I would agree with you. And I think it just comes down to the quality of the company, because we've seen today and many other days that good quality businesses on AIM attract capital, whether it's a IPO or whether it's basically onward placings, etc. So it really depends on the opportunity and the capital. And the advantage, obviously, of AIM is that you don't pay stamp duty and you get that 2-year relief, lower, you know, IHT relief. So, yeah, I'm with you. I mean, I look at my portfolio and I've probably got about 25% main market, but at least 2/3 anyway is AIM. Most of my shares are right. Certainly my big ones like Alico, Eagle Eye, Tribal, and Active Ops. Yeah, in fact, probably, yeah, I would say more than 75% is on AIM. So I'm with you. I look at it on a case-by-case basis.
I do, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Okay, good. We've got plenty of people. We've got Footy Meister, and we've got Dan asking about an AIM share, Avingtrans, who did a 21 million pound placing this morning at £6.30, which was no discount on the share price from the previous day, to help them fund a sort of five-year investment program into one of their divisions in the States to grow out their nuclear business, Hayward Tyler. What was your take on the fundraise? It seems the share price seems to have reacted pretty positively.
I haven't read it in detail, actually. I just saw it on one of the broker summary reports that came through. And as you say, the thing that jumps out at you is raising money at no discount. That is tremendously positive in the current environment where it's hard for smaller caps. This is only about 200 and just over 200 million market cap. We really like it. I was slow to the party on this one, but I'm now dancing away on the dance floor with everyone else. I think it's a really good business. Not optically cheap, but as you've pointed out in the past, there's a division that is a sort of slow build or something, or was even a loss maker, I think, that is now coming good. So but that became apparent, I think, last autumn in the numbers, and that's when I joined the party. So as in being bullish on it, I don't actually currently hold any, but we've been ambergreen on it six times, and the fact that it's raising money at no discount is very good, because that means they've gone to the institutions, given them a private briefing on what they want the money for, and the institutions love it. So, and very good for the UK market that small caps with good, strong stories, strong management can raise fresh capital. And that is really important. We're starting to see that happening, I think.
Yeah, and I had a quick look at it. And I mean, I think it looks like a no-brainer to me. I mean, when it comes to sort of big investments, you know, you look at it on a buy and build sort of approach. Should you buy a company that can give you this, like manufacturing, such you can, you haven't got to win market share, you haven't got the construction risk and all that kind of stuff. But yes, the problem with that is that currently businesses in the nuclear power sector are going for really rich multiples. And and just look at the ones particularly out in the States, sort of 15, 20 times EBITDA. Okay, so that would be, if you went on a buy, you know, an M&A approach, then that would be really expensive. Now, if you run the numbers on their organic growth strategy, they've raised 21 million and they reckon they can make in 5 years, just out of Hayward Tyler, who's receiving the funds, an extra approximately 10 million pound plus of EBITDA over 5 years.
Gosh,
so that's nearly 50% EBITDA return on investment, you know, per annum in 5 years.
Which is phenomenal.
Which is phenomenal, yeah. Now, you look at it on a perspective of the market cap. Market cap is currently about 220 million. Now, if you if you believe that they can hit their lowest estimate, not their upper one, but their lowest estimate for where Hayward Tyler is going to go on EBITDA, about 10 million, and just run a 12 times exit multiple on that valuation rather than a 15 to 20 times, which is what effectively the market's paying for it out in the state. But just do 12 times, you get 120 million. So you almost effectively double your market cap just by this investment. So effectively it's a six times money return. You get a minimum 120 million of NPV for 21 million of cash. So to be perfectly honest, I was not surprised that it was at no discount to the share price. In fact, I was almost surprised it wasn't a premium, because investors would bite the hand off for that type of opportunity, a potential sort of like, you know, six times money return. I mean, it sounds just like such a no-brainer.
It does, doesn't it? Yeah, and you might even see the people who participated in the fundraise or wanted to maybe doing follow-on purchasing in the market. So no, I completely agree. I mean, my colleague John covered this morning on our pre-8 a.m. report. It's only 9.8% of the existing capital, so that's not significant dilution really, and enable the growth of nuclear revenues from 35 million to 90 million. So it looks great, doesn't it?
Yeah, no, it's great. Okay, look, let's keep on the subject of American exceptionalism. I think it's one of your subscribers, Tortoise Investor. He's asking about Keller, the geotechnics expert that came out of the UK It basically does all the piling for sort of like construction, buildings, infrastructure. But it's got also a big and very fast-growing division out in the States that is growing on the coattails of construction of data centers, power stations, you name it. The shares are unbelievable. I remember when they were £6, and they're currently at 34. What was your take for a tortoise investor?
It's phenomenal. I mean, we love Keller. We moved up. We moved up from ambergreen to green on it last summer, when it was £13.89. So as you say, it's now £34. So we did actually flag this one to our readers just as it was starting to really take off last year. And at that time, it was on a PE of 7 and a dividend yield of 4%. When that, with a sound balance sheet as well, that's when that big move really started last year. So I'm glad that we were able to flag this to people. It's the most unlikely sounding story, isn't it, for a multi-bagger doing foundations type work, but it's phenomenal. In the latest news on it on 3 days ago was that they said the positive momentum is accelerating. North America, very strong, record volumes, significant increase in demand, 1.9 billion record order book. I mean, it's just fantastic. So, yeah, we're big fans. We're green on this. We've been green for a year. And it's still, you know, it's not expensive even now because those earnings are growing so rapidly. You look at that chart, don't you, and think, oh, it's, you know, it's just going to do a sort of blow off top or whatever and come grind all the way back down again. I don't think it's likely to. I mean, you'll always get some people banking profits, understandably. But the numbers still stack up for value investors. So whatever they're doing, it's working a treat, isn't it?
Yeah, no, it is good. Okay, let's move to this side of the pond and let's go to house builders. We've had quite a few of them recently in the press, which hasn't been a good... we've had Vistry, which is biggest... It used to be a FTSE 100 house builder, largely of affordable houses, social houses. Lots of speculation that they're going to have to do an emergency fundraise by investors. Likewise, we've got Henry Boot, who has been held out as going to have to got their one of their lenders have appointed advisors to go and look at their books. The same thing happened with Crest Nicholson, and we then had MJ Gleeson today talking about the house builders. How do you see this sector, particularly in the lens with Andy Burnham looking as though he's coming in? Is this going to be is this going to be the moment of truth that we start seeing an inflection point, or is it essentially some of the low sort of low quality businesses are going to go belly up?
Well, who knows, Paul? I mean, overall, you know, obviously we're all aware of all these really serious headwinds. One of my correspondents says, look, Paul, the problem is build cost has gone up by 40% in the last, I'm not sure what period he mentioned, but certainly since the pandemic, which means that a lot of the land that some of these builders bought, maybe marginal land, it's not worth them building on it now. So it's definitely sorting the wheat from the chaff in this sector, isn't it? I'm very nervous about Vistry, but it could go either way. I don't have a strong view on it because it put an update out 2 days ago, which was basically, well, the CFO resigned, announced his resignation in October. Well, that's not good. But it also says, you know, it's taking emergency actions to de-gear and it'll have net cash by the end of the year. Well, no bank is likely to pull the plug on a business that's doing what the bank wants them to do, which is raising cash. So, but again, set against that, it's this can of worms argument, isn't it, with Vistry? It's what else is lurking. It's same with Crest Nicholson. Every time we believe the turnaround story and whatnot, some other horror story comes out of the woodwork. So I just take the view when you can buy the real quality operators at huge discounts that are generally actually trading okay, why get involved in the special situations? So I was actually pleased with Gleeson this morning. I have to say, you and I both hold Gleeson.
Yeah.
We had the mother of all rows from the CEO who went berserk at me.
I know. So no, it was both of us.
So I think you're using your platform to do this, this, and this. And we thought, what? We like the company. We're shareholders in it. So I think that was just a good example of when not to press the send button. don't send emails when you're angry. I've learned that from hard experience too. But no, I thought the update today from Gleeson was good, in line with expectations, which, given that it's disappointed a number of times, obviously uncertain outlook, but that's for everyone. It's at a massive discount to net tangible asset value now, and it's almost ungeared. So I think I'm pretty bullish on Gleeson now. I think maybe the worm has turned there, so fingers crossed. But over to you, Paul. What are your thoughts?
Well, I mean, I think at the moment, if the market doesn't change, we're going to start seeing some. We're going to have to start bringing the dead out, and I think the dead bodies are going to be people like Crest, Henry Boot doesn't look good. Whenever a lender puts in advisors, you know you're going to struggle. Because they take control of the payments, basically. They take over the divestments of the, or effective disbursements of monies. And, you know, you're really you're behind the black ball on that one. With Vistry, personally, I think it's still got a chance, no doubt about it, because it's big. And the government likes it, okay? Now, unless Andy Burnham comes in, okay, unless he does an FA Cup on it, okay, then you should think actually the housing market will do well, particularly in the affordable homes, because as you've rightly been talking about, all of the 39 million of the affordable homes bill that was essentially allocated to, you know, cheaper houses for people, that should start being allocated and dispersed in September. And so we're only talking about 2 months' time. And so unless Andy Burnham says, sorry, that isn't going to happen, I think that could change the dial for likes of Vistry. And I think it could be a big boost for Gleeson as well. But if it doesn't happen, I think Vistry is in real trouble. But I don't think Gleeson is, even if it doesn't. Because I think they've, from their statement this morning, I think they've basically batten down the hatches for expect bad news, which is continued bad news. But actually, if we get a good one, then fantastic. We're well placed to benefit. And they do a big affordable homes business as well. So I think Gleeson is very well placed on both of its good or bad. But I could certainly see if Andy Burnham does an FA Cup on that social housing money, is the 39 million, if that doesn't get out into the housing market, I think banks are going to start closing some of them, you know, in terms of particularly Henry Boot. If Henry Boot goes, that's good for Gleeson because they operate in a similar sort of area, actually.
That Sky story on Henry Boot really rattled me. Because I've been an FD in a company when the bank sends in accountants to assess it, and it's very often the banks use it as a way of kind of justifying pulling the rug out. I'm not suggesting that happens, but it's a serious warning sign when the bank sends in investigating accountants, I think. So I wouldn't touch Boot. I've decided to just not go near Vistry or Crest Nicholson because I don't see the need to take the risk when I'm getting Gleeson at like a 60% or more discount to net tangible asset value, and they only pay 10 grand a plot for each plot, you know, so the land values, in because it's just tiny starter homes, you know, just as the CEO of Gleeson told us on a Zoom we had with him, which was fascinating. He said any kind of stimulus measure from the government and we're off to the races, you know, because these are starter homes, these are the type of homes that people want. They're very affordable already. For me, Gleeson would be the pick. But I think also some of the much bigger ones are much more resilient and are generally putting out actually okay trading updates. So I think focus on quality when you don't need to touch the dross, you know, that's my view.
The one thing I would say about the bigger house builders, just be careful about their cladding exposure, because that seems to getting bigger and bigger and bigger, and people are talking about much larger potential liabilities going forward. Now, Gleeson doesn't have it, okay? It has a very, very minor exposure to cladding. So it's outside. It's never really done, blocks of flats and that kind of stuff. So I personally would be very wary of Taylor Wimpey, because I know it has a big one. I think Fitzsimmons also has quite a big cladding provision. I don't think Barrett's do, other than they're up more at market one. But anyway, just be careful, be quite discriminating, because you don't want to be.
That is true, and those provisions tend to grow, don't they? And although they're on the balance sheet, the creditor turns into a cash outflow at some point. Yeah. So you still got to find the cash for the creditor. And there was the article in the Independent, wasn't there? Yet another a punch in the face for shareholders and house builders over this legal case that has apparently been mooted against, I think, the seven biggest house builders for mis-selling.
Yes, you're exactly right. Yeah, that's right. The collusion.
So it's one thing after another, isn't it?
No, I know. And also, I mean, just on Vistry, actually, they're the most shorted stock in the UK at 15.2% at the moment. So a lot of very professional investors think it's a bag of SH.
But of course, that can flip the other way, can't it? You know, it could be a short squeeze. So no, I just don't see the need to take those levels of risk. Yeah. When we've got so many bargains sitting on a plate where you've just got a nice clean situation, why get involved in these special ones?
Yeah, okay. Well, let's go to another one which is heavily shorted. It's Capita, 7.9% short interest. Ian's asking about it. Came out with some pretty awful news this week that one of its large contracts for the government, in fact, I think it's for the MPs pension schemes and civil servants pension schemes, it hasn't been meeting its KPIs and service levels. In fact, I think quite a few people who have not been able to get their pension and they've eventually died out having to wait for it. So it's been an absolute tragic situation. Anyway, they came out and scaled the potential loss and the extra cost they're having to incur, which I think was about 30-40 million, which is quite material compared to the market cap and to their How do you see, we've got a big fan at Richard Staveley of Lockwood who keeps having a go at us about it, and we're still sort of like holding our breath on it. But when you look at the share chart, when I was looking at the 10-year one, it was at 90 quid back in 2016. 10 years
was
later,
it really?
10 years later, is at £2.15. Yeah, it's £2.20. What's your view putting it all together on Capita?
Well, I mean, I've listened to all of Richard's stuff and other bulls, you know, all their stuff on it, and you know, far be it from me to disagree with them, because I think they're saying, look, it's sorting itself out. It's now got these two very good divisions, whatever. So I suppose I'll be very interested to hear an update from Richard about how he sees it, because I think you can look at it both ways, can't you? I mean, we covered the update from the Paymaster General statement on 6th of July, which I read the statement pre 8 a.m. and thought, oh my God, you know, this is disastrous. It was it couldn't have been more critical of Capita. But, you know, as some people have pointed out, well, maybe the civil service are partly to blame as well, and heaping all the blame on Capita. I don't know. But Capita then put out an acknowledgement of this and said, yes, we know that our service hasn't been bad enough. Then it put out a more detailed update yesterday, didn't it? Emphasizing that they're hitting 90% of their KPIs within the business as a whole. So Capita is trying to, they've won a record 1 billion in total contract value and new contracts in H1. But my argument on this is, how can they keep winning contracts when they get these disastrous mess ups which just keep happening and seemingly getting worse? And yeah, here we are, 25 million to 40 million profit hit from just this one problem contract on the back of a really weak balance sheet. This is the other thing, negative 356 million net tangible asset value. So I just don't want to get involved. I'm glad I've stuck to my guns on this and said I couldn't assess risk reward, but it just has a horrible habit of just disappointing over and over and over again. As you say, over probably decades. I mean, has it really transformed into an amazing, clean, AI-enabled business? I just don't believe it. I think you've got to really ask the questions. Can these guys actually manage anything? Or is it just an organization that's just beset with incompetence and failing? You know, can you imagine AI bots trying to automate these processes, just blagging people? I mean, I'm probably missing an opportunity here, but again, why get involved? I just don't need to get involved, and I don't really want to.
Yeah, I mean, until I start seeing the top line going up, I'm staying well clear of it, because they have that working capital unwind, because they get payments up front, and therefore they get, not only do they lose business and shrink, they're essentially losing cash because they have to give back their deposits. So That's one of the reasons why I've been avoiding it for years. And then the other main reason, just more recently, is AI disintermediation or potential disintermediation, because AI is there to take out white-collar outsourcers. You know, why do you need thousands of people running big, outsourcing contracts? You don't need them. So I think the market, the TAM, the total addressable market for white collar outsourcing is actually going to come under pressure going forward. And it's already ferocious. The competition in these things is ferocious. Okay. So yeah, I'm with you. I think this is in the hard bucket, but when I interviewed Richard, I mean, he obviously has gone through this in massive detail and does a very, very thorough sum of the parts on it. And to be for credit to him, he did, when I last interviewed him, which was only about 2 months ago, he did highlight this pension contract has been still the last one we've got to get rid of. So he knew something was coming on this one. I don't think he expected it to be quite so bleak, but he certainly planned where, you know, he's gone through it with a fine tooth comb, put it that way.
I know. And I'm just for clarity, I'm not disagreeing with him. I'm not saying he's wrong. You know, I mean, and looking at the chart as well, it's found support around this level now, two or three times, where actually this is around about the point about £2.20-ish, where the bulls sort of overwhelm the sellers. So it could go back up again, couldn't it? I'm just totally agnostic on it. I'm not saying anybody's right or wrong. I just don't know.
Yeah. Okay, let's move to different sectors. Let's go to payments. We've got Syed Hussein. He says he got hurt by Boku this week, which came out with a bit of a shocking profit warning. Shares fell 32%. These guys basically do direct carrier billing, plus they do payment wallets, I think, for some of their subscribers, and a bundling of subscriptions. They're a bit like, they're more advanced level than Bango. They've been very much sort of like a star over the last few years about continuing to grow. What was your take on this pretty surprising major profit warning, actually?
Yeah, surprise, as you say. I mean, this was a highly rated, you know, star growth stock, wasn't it? I've never followed it that closely because I just couldn't really get my head around the growth in the business model. And I've never been, we were just amber on it, which is our don't know sort of rating. But I was certainly surprised at the size of the downgrade, which came through 2 days ago, didn't it? 8th of July. Saying the full year EBITDA below market expectations, which seemed to be around 20% downgrade on EBITDA, which is a hell of a big downgrade, isn't it? For, you know, a growth darling, you just can't miss by that much. So, I just doesn't interest me, so I didn't dig into the details. So, I mean, have you looked into why it's missed by such a long way, Paul?
Yeah, they've had certain contracts that have been suspended, plus they've lost some vendors as well. So they've had, it's been quite sort of like, customer-specific issues that they've had. But more broadly, the reason why I haven't bought the shares is that essentially when you've got such a big part of your business, a bit like Bango as well, which is direct carrier billing, this is old technology. This allows an individual who hasn't got a bank account, particularly in Asia or South America, to buy things and then put it onto their telephone bill and then pay your telephone bill with those extra purchases. So it gives you effectively like a quasi bank. That is old technology. We don't use that at all in the UK, or hardly in the UK. We did originally like 25 years ago, and in America, because I can remember there was lots of purchases on your telephone bill. But what's replaced it with is things like Wise, Revolut, Monzo, because they have your own peer-to-peer, you know, account, and you can just pay straight through from there. So when it comes to direct carrier billing, I think what's the long-term decline in it is in Asia, as you've got the proliferation of these fintechs out in, you know, sort of like South America and into Southeast Asia, India, Pakistan, these kind of places. More and more people have their own, you know, Wise account, Revolut account, whatever it is. And therefore, they don't need separate direct carrier billing, where the take rate is pretty high. And effectively, we know from Wise, the take rate is less than 0.5%. It's a much cheaper, faster system. So The reason why I've always avoided Boku is that I've never got my head around the perpetual growth in direct carrier billing. And I remember when you and I spoke to Bango and the management team there, and I asked them directly, how do you see direct carrier billing as a industry going? And they reckoned it was going to be 5 to 10% per annum growth going forward. And I said, I just can't get my head. I just don't believe it. And they came out with a trading update and said it's declined. And then likewise with Boku this week, they've said that it hasn't grown as much. So I just think there's a headwind in this whole direct carrier billing sector for the companies that have been running on the coattails of emerging markets, which historically have needed it, but won't need it as much going forward. And they're now hitting a lot of competition against really ferocious fintechs who offer these same people direct accounts, like Wise, Revolut, and these kind of guys. So, yeah, I think there's still it's come down a lot. I personally wouldn't be jumping on this one either. Because I think it's a value trap.
Yeah, it's interesting you mentioned Bango, because I remember when we've had a couple of very good Zooms with them, and it's amazing. I remember from that call how different each country's payments infrastructure are. And the UK, which might surprise people, is one of the world's most advanced, if not the most advanced, actually. And a lot of like Germany and Japan, you know, major economies, still have quite antiquated customs in terms of how people pay bills, and the large amounts of cash are still in use in lots of advanced countries. Oh, breaking news, possible offer for SafeStay.
Oh, wow. They're pretty small, aren't they, SafeStay? Aren't they?
Tiny, yeah. This is the property, the hostels thing. Shares up 141%.
Oh, right.
Yeah, exciting. Yeah.
Well, I think what is the market cap on it, on SafeStay? I mean,
it was about 9 million prior to this. It's now 21 million. That's very interesting. So anyway, well done to any holders of that. Sorry, I've broken the flow a bit there, Paul.
Yeah, no,
so
that's all right.
Bango and Boku. Yes. Yeah, no, I'm not. I am actually quite intrigued by Bango, because a day or two ago, Bango put out an update that was only in line, but the ARR was up 31%. And the market caught hold of that, and Bango shares went up 23% on the day. So that one, from a very low point, but Bango, I think, might be worth our listeners having a fresh look at, actually. No, you're not keen?
I think that, and the problem is, even if you're direct, the thing which is nice is that digital vending machine application.
Yes, that's what you're buying, not the legacy stuff. Yeah.
Yeah, but the direct to carrier billing is still the biggest profit generator for them, and I just don't think they're going to get that. I would wait until that inflection happens, because there's too much uncertainty about direct carrier billing, in my view.
Okay. Well, fair enough. Yeah.
Yeah, would be my take. Okay, good. We've got plenty of people. We've got Ben Sharman. We had David from one of your subscribers. And we also had somebody else asking about it. But they're all asking about Vitrex. Is this the turnaround? In fact, yes. I think Cotney Rebel was also mentioning it on his weekly blast yesterday. These guys are specialists in plastic polymers, or PEEK polymer, which basically is super lightweight. It's resistance to high temperature, low temperature, and it's very hard. It replaces steel, aluminium, and other expensive materials in applications like planes, EVs, all kinds of different steel and in medical. They came out with the shares have done terrible over the last 4 years. I owe them disclosure, so I'm well underwater. But anyway, they came out with a quarterly trading update, and they said it was going to be in line, but their quarter revenues were up like 15, 16, 17%. What was your take on it?
Very positive. This reported on 7th of July, and that was the main share I focused on that morning of that day. We got out a thing pre 8 a.m. as always, because we like to flag trading opportunities to people. And I said to my colleague John, I said, I think this is looking a really good turnaround. He said, actually, I think you're right as well. So we upped it from amber to amber green on the pre 8 a.m. on the 7th of July. And I'm glad we did, because it rose 16%. So that was a really good steer we gave to our subscribers there. As you say, it was a Q3 update, revenue up 18%. Pulling the year-to-date revenue up to 7%. It did say in line for the September year-end forthcoming, but I went through the detail and posted up a more detailed section on it. And my conclusion was, I think they're being cautious. I think they want to beat those numbers, and they're probably heading for a beat. They're cost cutting as well. New CEO came in about 6 months ago, is got rid of 10% of the workforce, which is obviously painful, but it that should give a £10 million boost to profitability from annualized, I think that is, from Q4. It's also got a good balance sheet with very modest net debt, a cost cutting underway, and very strong top line growth started to come back in. I think this looks really good. So, yeah, I mean, I have no position in the shares myself, but I probably would have bought some if I'd had any spare cash on the morning of that update. I think this looks a real credible turnaround now. So, yeah, I think you might. I mean, it's fallen so much, hasn't it? It's gone from a growth stock rating to a value share rating. I think there's scope for this to re-rate. Wouldn't surprise me if, you know, it could start a new uptrend. So, yeah, I like it. Thumbs up from me.
Yeah, that was the basis with Cotney Rebel. He said he knows the company pretty well, because I think he was into what was that big engineering company that came out with a huge profit warning recently?
Goodwin.
Goodwin, yes. And they have one of their products that doesn't compete exactly with Peak, but it's a similar sort of market anyway. So he's been watching Vitrex, and his view was that. The shares are definitely, because he's you know, definitely bowling. Let's put it these 6 months. You know, they've reached that bowl, and the new CEO coming in, shaking up the management team. Now,
yes,
the thing to really understand in Vitrex, okay, is most of the money has come from their medical business. They make like 78% gross margins, and the rest of it is about sort of like 40-50%. So the real dial shifter is that medical division. And what was encouraging in the last quarter, they said it's stabilized. And they're hoping at the end of this year or early next year to get approval in India as the first jurisdiction for this new Peak knee, which could be an absolute winner for them, a home run, i.e., for new joints. So this that's one of the reasons why I've continued to hold them to my disgust so far, because I'm in a long way down. I bought it about 14, 15 quid, I think it was, which was about half of where they were, but they've halved again. So, yes, I would love to think they're on to a turnaround, but personally, I would wait. And for me, anyway, I'm not adding to the position. If you want to, I still think this is quite the reason why they've been losing market. They haven't been doing so well in medical, is they've been losing market share. So to say it's stabilized is great. Mm. They're not losing any more. But they haven't. The business has not been run very well in that medical, in particular, over the number of years, and that's really where a lot of the money comes to. So if you start seeing medical like for like revenue going up, then absolutely game on. We're really moving, because that will, you'll see a big jump. But you're not seeing it yet. It could just be a flat patch and then go down. So I still think there's plenty of risk. The shares are priced with plenty of risk into it, no doubt about it. And it might well be that now the cycle for medicine with things like Peak Polymer is going really well. So, well, it will come really, you know, do well. So I'm hold for me, but I wouldn't be filling my boots on it. That's for sure.
Well, that's interesting. A nice balanced view there. And this is also one where we've been flagging that divvies are not covered by earnings. So don't run away with the idea that the 8-9% dividend yield is sustainable. But I think that's widely known. I think the market is fully aware of that. And so if they reset the dividend to about half the current level, I think probably a 4-5% dividend yield looks sustainable, and that's good, of course. And then it did flag tailwinds from the aerospace and the electronic sectors, so it's quite diversified, I think, isn't it? But I take your point about medical. So no, I think it looks really interesting, so definitely high on my watch list of potential buys. But quite often when things do it, like a 16% rise on results, they drift, don't they, afterwards? So I might just bide my time on this and wait and see.
Okay, we got WMin13. He's asking about Johnson Service Group. I think came out with effectively a trading update this morning, which hasn't been well received. It's 14% down, actually. I did see they're in line with their profit margin expectations for the full year.
Right.
But they had flat revenues, and I presume they were a bit... less clear of their trading update, because it implied that they were in line, but actually they're not in line because their sales aren't growing as they anticipated.
Hence
I'm guessing. I don't know. I mean, unless I'm missing something. Anyway, what was your any reasons why the shares are down 14%? I suspect that somebody's downgraded the numbers.
Well, that's what normally happens, isn't it? When you get an inline update and shares open lower and just continue going down, it's because one of the premium brokers has slipped out a downgrade and we don't know about it, which is very unfair, I think. So, but anyway, no, in our pre-8 a.m. take on this, we thought we just flagged it as in line. H1 revenue was in line with the prior year. Energy costs well hedged. Pleased with margin progression. This is our summary of the thing. £55 million buyback in progress. And then on the outlook, it said calendar 26 in line. And yes, you're right. On track towards delivering our targeted adjusted operating margin of at least 14%. So this has been a good margin improvement story over multiple years. So we like it. We're green on the share. So I am, I'm quite surprised it's down 15% at quarter to 12. Yeah, that is surprising, isn't it? So no, we'll have to do a bit more digging on that. But we like it. We think it's good business.
I think it hasn't met its sales targets. I think that, and therefore, if you're going to be flat, then okay, you might have the margin. But if you're going to be flat, you're not going to increase your numbers, are you? So, I think that's what it's come down to. And people have said, well, if this thing's not growing, then, and it's only on its margins, it means somebody's, the earnings are coming
down. Certainly a 15% drop in share price means the market's interpreted this as a mild profit warning, don't they?
Yeah.
So maybe they used weasel words in the statement to, maybe it wasn't really in line. That really annoys me when PRs get hold of the RNSs and they put, we're in line with, and then some obscure metric that isn't profit. And you think, don't try and kid us. But maybe they did successfully pull the wool over my eyes. Anyway, I didn't spot that. Sorry. Yeah.
Okay. We've got a question actually for hanging over from last week. A guy called Ian Davies, one of your subscribers, I think.
Yes. Hello, Ian.
Life science. He's asking about Tristel or Tristel. Basically, they do chlorine dioxide decontaminants for essentially small medical instruments. Things go like colonoscopies, endoscopies, and nose, ear, and throat. And they do foams as well. But their big blockbuster one is this. It's a three wipe type product that is easy to manufacture, great margins, and it's very, very easy to use in hospitals, and they've had a lot of success with the NHS in the UK, branched out overseas, and then they've moved now into the US, and that's what people are hoping is going to be the next big market to hit. So I think they're using a distributor, Parker, somebody or other, to be able to, in the States. Anyway, putting all that together, how do you see this one?
Well, we've not had any news for ages. The last time we covered it was on the 2nd of March, the H1 results, which were good. High margins, potential big runway in the US, as you stated. This is just my summary notes from that day. 4% yield, lovely balance sheet with plenty of net cash. It's got a good track record, hasn't it? And the thing I like about Tristel or Tristel is that during the pandemic, obviously their sales and their share price were hit badly. And they said, look, this is temporary because of elective surgery stopping because of the pandemic. It'll come back. And it did. And that's always good, isn't it? When companies say this is what's going to happen and it does happen. So I like it. I think the only question mark we've had over this is the valuation probably up with events now. And also, I think the patent lifetimes was a bit of a question mark, wasn't it? Because it's not particularly complex. Well, it's simple chemistry, but it's patents over the specialized packaging, I think, that is its USP. And there was a bit of a question mark over how long that could last, I think.
Yeah, I did a bit of investigation actually on on their patents, and some of their early patents have definitely expired. They were started to expire 10 years ago, but their newer ones, which is effectively the products, the best selling ones, I think their patents are until mid the 2030s, so around about, they've got another 10 years. No, nearly 20. Well, they've got a long time on it. Yeah, nearly 10 years to go. So I think they're probably okay. My only take on it is how doable is it to get into the US healthcare system? Because it's got a number of strong competitors out there. Now, the UK has all, and the overseas has always been cheap and cheerful because they've always gone for manual decontamination, manual cleaning of instruments, and therefore wipes and foams and fluids and stuff has worked really well because it's a cheap, you haven't got to buy any CapEx, you haven't got to use electricity because it's all manually done, etc. But in the States, it's a different game, okay? It's a bigger scale, and they use industrial cleaners, they use ultraviolet to clean products and stuff, and so it's a CapEx game. And so consequently, just if you're a US hospital and you're doing a lot of cleaning of high value medical instruments, etc., then you'd say, okay, now what's the incremental benefit of me to bin my CapEx that I've already spent and go manual and ask my doctors and nurses in particular to clean as they go through the procedures? What is the incremental ROI on it? And actually, it's quite a tough one. It's only the there isn't much white space, and so they're competing against entrenched competitors who have already put CapEx into US hospitals. So I think this adoption in the States is going to be a slow burn, simply because the ROI for a hospital about putting new manual technology isn't going to work. And we know from Craneware, hospitals are on their knees in the States because they've been hit by, all this insurance and reimbursements and all this sort of stuff. They're not making much money at all. So I think they'll continue to do well in the UK, overseas, but I suspect the US, if they do well in the US, that would surprise me, because I think it's quite an ingrained, entrenched market.
Okay. Yeah. No, I mean, I don't know anything about that level of detail on it, but the value metrics look, when it was sort of 14, 15 times PE, I thought it was good value. 19, 20 times. Yeah. Gibson, 4696 here says 19 times PE on Tristel up with events, ? Yeah. I'd say the same, because it's not kind of groundbreaking exponential growth type of product or company, is it? So yeah, maybe priced about right. I don't know.
Yeah. Okay, good. Let's go to gambling. We've got Rebecca asking about Playtech that came out with results this week that were well received. I think their shares are up double digits on the day. These guys do software for casino gamblers, sportsbook, I think, around the world. They've got a big business out in the States, or growing. I think it's with Hard Rock, sort of like casino. They power that. And also they've got a potential joint venture in Brazil, which could be a big market. And they've got in, obviously, they do well out, across the world, etc. Quite a big business. How do you view this whole sector? Not Playtech in particular.
Well, the sector I don't really have a view on, but Playtech in particular, this was a cracking update yesterday, 9th of July, and we actually moved it up from amber to amber green pre-8 a.m, and the shares then rose 14% on the day. It was an excellent update, significantly ahead of market expectations, it said, for H1, and it also said significantly above for the full year expectations for 26, calendar 26, that was at the EBITDA level. We can't get any broker upgrades on it, but reports on it, but it was a very strong update for sure. So that's why we moved it up from 3-star to 4-star effectively. And the PE is still reasonable, growing into punchy forecasts, my colleague wrote here. Obviously, you've got some gambling sector risk, but looks good, doesn't it? There was some attack on Playtech, wasn't there? Or did it attack someone else? There was something. Maybe it's that vertical drop in the share price that you just showed there. I can't remember what it was, but was it plagiarism or unethical practices? There was something, wasn't there, a while back? Can you remember anything about that?
No, I can't. No, they've had quite a checkered past. I think that decrease is a huge return. I think they sold a big business, a division, and I think that's a return of capital, actually. It's like a special, massive special divvy.
Oh, was it Snail Tech or something?
Yeah, I think, don't they? Yeah,
Snail Tech or Snay Tech, something like that. Yeah,
maybe. But they've had a checkered history. And the thing is about the problem from you know, it's software, which is good because obviously selling air, which is great, and the other people take the effectively the jurisdiction risk your partners do rather than you do. But the whole area of gambling, it can change like the wind very quickly, because suddenly, like the UK, they put a new online gambling tax on, which they're obviously is a bit of a headwind to them. You had the States back in 2006 that put the online the wire the Wire Act that blasted all of things like all the poker boys and stuff like this. So yes. I just think there's too much regulatory risk for me, and I like software, but I don't particularly like gambling software because it's just too volatile. Yes. But these guys seem to be doing very well. They're
doing
well,
aren't they?
They are.
And actually, on ShareScope, you can actually change the graph settings to include total return, which includes all the cumulative divvies, which while you were talking, I did that. And you're right. The total shareholder return has been very, very strong. And it's because they paid out massive, I think, special divvies or tenders or something at the point where the share price dropped. So, yeah, the total shareholder return has actually been pretty good on this, much better than you would imagine from just looking at the normal share price.
Okay, good. Let's go sectors. We go to online travel agents. We've got Lorenzo asking about Hostel World. They came out with results, he says, this week. They did, but these guys basically or a travel agent ideally for hostels, but they do for all hotels as well. And their sort of USP is that they've got this social media network thing that people use, and it allows them to meet mates and friends and all this sort of stuff at the hostels. How do you see it?
Well, we had an update from it yesterday. We're amber green, so we think it's good value, basically. But we have put a question mark over where's the growth coming from. You know, it's priced now like a value share because it kind of is a value share. You know, there's it said, although it did say net revenue was up 12% in its trading update yesterday, but no change in full year guidance. It says a little bit of minor impact from the Middle East situation, but nothing serious. It's paid off the debt and it's in a net cash position now. So it's a good value business, but I think we're a bit skeptical about the social media aspect of it, because I would have thought if you book a hostel, yes, you want to interact with the other young people there, obviously, but surely that would be just through the hostel's Facebook page. I don't know why you'd care that maybe one or two people in that hostel book through Hostel World. Most of them probably don't. They book through another provider. So I don't really get it. But there again, I'm not the target market and I don't know what I'm talking about. But that's my main... it never stops me. But, you know, that I think we need to ask any young people we know, look, have you used this and is the social media thing any good?
Yeah, I mean, I'm bearish on all of online travel agents. I think their USP is going to get not killed, but I think it's just going to get disintermediated and gradually eroded by ChatGPT and AI and this sort of stuff, because people are going to use their agents to do it. Well, I am anyway. Eventually, when it gets good enough, and I think that whole as I said before, anything which has got a business model which is predicated on difficulty currently for consumers, confusion about pricing and all this sort of stuff, and where it makes it easier. If you've got a business model on that, then you're fair game for AI and agentic AI and all of those websites. The online travel agents are exactly that. They just make it easier at the moment, and I think it's going to get easier and easier with ChatGPT and when you go through your old agent. So I personally wouldn't. I think they're all value traps myself, and that's a bit harsh.
Yeah, I'm diverging from you increasingly on this. I'm getting more and more skeptical on AI, actually. Yeah. I think because they're not apt to backed, you know, they can't offer the guarantee. I think there's still... I just don't see AI having much effect at all. But I could be wrong, of course.
Okay, we'll answer that question in 2 to 3 years' time. Okay, yes. we've got Yeti. He's asking about a recruiter, Hayes. Did they come out with a statement?
There was something, wasn't there?
The shares anyway. The shares are up 13%, so it must have been better than it, or not as bad.
Yeah, here
as
we are. Expected. That's right. This was today. It was the Q4 update. Net fees still down 5% year on year, but strong progress on cost savings. But I think what the market likes about this is partly Richard Crowe flagging it as a bowl, and also that it said that the this is for the June 2026 year end, it expects operating profit at the top end of the consensus range, which is quite a broad range, 37 million to 46 million. So being at the top end of a fairly wide range, that's good news, I think. But that was countered by it saying, Hayes saying limited forward visibility. So I'm actually starting to think about sniffing around this sector again. I've done that a couple of times over that last precipitous drop that we've seen over the last 5 or 6 years. I mean, this has been a horrendous period for the sector since, well, for the last 5 years, doesn't it? Just goes lower and lower and lower. There must at some point be some bargains, I think. So, yeah, I think along with actually, funnily enough, the online legal firms as well, and the online, and sorry, and the staffing companies, those are two sectors I'm going to start looking at with fresh eyes for maybe some bargains, maybe some green shoots.
Okay, you gotta convince me here, Paul. Okay, now I'm guessing you're playing for a cyclical recovery. Is that correct in recruitment?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not sold on. I haven't decided to push the button on it, but I think I'm increasingly to hearing what companies are saying. They're just not hiring for a whole variety of reasons. Very, very few. In fact, I can only think of one in my universe of 800 companies has said they're taking on fewer entry-level people because of AI. That was Knight's Group. But other than that, I think, yes, I think this is a particularly severe structural downturn. I'm not convinced that AI is having that much effect, but I think you're probably going to strongly disagree with me. So over to you.
Well, if your thesis is right, okay, that we're going to get a cyclical recovery at some point in time, then what's happened in those countries, non-UK, non-Europe, where you have seen a cyclical recovery, like the States, for instance, places in Asia, that haven't made any difference at all to these shares, and it hasn't made any difference in terms of negative, you know, basically like-for-like fees, even in strong markets where you've had cyclical recoveries. You tell me one which has done well out of it, okay? And I can't think of any at all.
So I think with some of the global ones, I think they have had, there've been a number of ones I've looked at that are UK listed and are global that have said there are quite big disparities and that UK and Europe are down whilst other geographies have gone up. So I think it has been quite mixed actually, to be fair, Paul, on the geographic split.
So you think that it basically, you know, with the US doing well and some other countries which are in a cyclical up to 20, you basically, what you're saying is that, yes, that does verifies the fact that when we get one in the UK and Europe, it will actually push it up. Because I don't think it is. I don't think they're getting much operating leverage at all in even those areas, because it just hasn't come through in the shares.
It's certainly not a powerful sort of V-shaped recovery. You're right on that completely. But yeah, I mean, just going through the granularity of the split, and there are quite strong differences between different regions, I think. And somebody sent me an interesting article, actually, just quickly on the staffing companies, saying that some of these organizations are morphing into specialist niches. It's like Gattaca has done very well. So the ones that kind of address... one example is there's companies are crying out for applicants who have got AI skills and who can go into an organization and say, right, this is what you should be doing. That's what you should be doing. So staffers, I think, have got an opportunity to target niches. So that's what I'm looking for from maybe groups like Hayes are a bit too big to be doing that. I don't know, but yeah. I'm only saying tentatively. I'm not going to pile into the sector.
Okay, cool.
Yeah.
Okay. Another one. We'll wait for 2 years. Let's see what happens. Okay. Let's go to heavily indebted floor coverings business. Victoria came out with a refinancing of its preference shares, largely. But it said it made it out as its senior secured debt, which it was. But it was mainly its pref shares. Shares shot up actually around about 24%. They're actually up again today, about 3%. Have we reached the turning point for Victoria? Because this really has taken a lot of shareholders to the woodshed.
Yeah, it's been a disaster. Basically, they've did the buy and build thing, but with way, way, way too much gearing, and then hit a recession, which that's the big risk, isn't it, of over-gearing. I mean, I listened to their webinar yesterday where they tried to explain the refinancing, but I just got the feeling I didn't have the full information. I mean, it showed how something like £300 million of the net debt just vanishes. And they gave a kind of explanation that the holder, I think you said, is it preferred shares or something like
it's
that?
It's mainly the preferred shares. They've basically converted them into ordinary shares, because essentially the real value, preferred shares, just for everybody, basically, they're not debt, but you have to pay a dividend, okay? But you don't have to pay a dividend. They've actually not been paying a dividend because they haven't got enough cash to do it. And therefore, the real market value of those pref shares is not at the nominal par value. It's a lot less. And so consequently, by converting them, they've been able to say that because of there's a gap between the market value of the pref shares and the nominal value is like 300 million quid. And therefore, they've been able to say they've refinanced it at the market value, which is just really converting those prefs into essentially ordinary shares.
Yeah, this is it. And they didn't explain the proper amount of dilution. And they kept referring to we've eliminated the need for near term dilution, which of course means there's going to be some future dilution. So I sat and listened through this webinar. I read the RNS twice. I haven't got enough information, and I feel what we need is a pro forma balance sheet, chapter and verse on the terms of all the individual elements. And you've still got, you know, a massively negative balance sheet. But I did have it on a red, which is my, you know, major warning, potential insolvency. I've taken that warning off, because I think the key thing, isn't it, is who wants to protect the value of the equity, the ordinary shares. And it looks in this case, if they've managed to do something pretty clever, which is to align the debt holders with the ordinary equity holders. So that, I think, is really good, actually. Whether the business actually has much value, you know, over and above the debt, that's the big question, isn't it? But I think that this could be quite interesting. If I think people need to really do their homework properly on it, could this be a turning point? It's possible. I'm
a more skeptical, to be perfectly honest, because I did do the numbers on it, and looking at their next year's operating profit, it's not going to be enough to pay off their new revised lower interest bill anyway, never mind any other sort of payments that they have to make. So on a cash perspective, it's still going to be outgoing. And it's only the following year that then the EBIT becomes higher than the interest bill. So they've still got a lot of heavy lifting to do. If you don't see a cyclical recovery in the housing market, or carpeting and tiling on floors and this sort of stuff, I think they're going to go back again and having to restructure that. So But then again, you know, the shares are saying, you know, it's very, very high risk, and they're on the, you know, on the floor, aren't they? So.
And it's more than, you know, it's more than tripled from the lows when it looked like it was going to go bust. So this could be a special situation trade, I think. You know, for me, it's not a long-term investment. For traders who've dug into the detail, they've already done well on it. So, and I think this was a game-changing announcement. It took away that kind of imminent risk of collapse, didn't it? Yeah. So potentially interesting for special situations investors, but not for me.
No, not for me either. I did see one of the brokers doing a revised net debt to EBITDA ratio, and it's still about 7 or 8 times even after the refinance. So, you know, I mean, it's highly geared. Okay, let's go to another one, which is in the recovery ward. We got in marketing this one's turnaround. Next 15. This used to be a darling about 5 years ago. Michael's asking about it. They basically do a lot of specialisms in sort of digital marketing and digital transformation, but they had this huge, they bought this business called Mac49 some time ago, which it basically crashed and went to zero. And then they've got this huge legal claim on sort of secondary or deferred consideration, which is, I think the claim, it could potentially about 70 million quid. Anyway, putting all that together, how do you see this one?
I've just stayed away from it. I mean, we're amber on it. We had an update 2 days ago on the 8th of July, which was the AGM trading update, in line with expectations. Partial sale of Track 2 business agreed, trading in line for the full year, which is January 27. So it looks stable, doesn't it? We're not keen on the balance sheet. It's got the last balance sheet at January 26 was negative net tangible asset value of minus 83 million, which is a quite a big number, isn't it? And as you say, do take into account that net debt doesn't look that high, but there's deferred consideration creditors, and which you mentioned, and they've got this arbitration shadow looming over it. So I think, yes, it's on a low PE, and yes, you've got an apparently high dividend yield, but again, I can buy something like Advanced ADVT or Saatchi. You know, if I want to buy a marketing business, I can buy something that's pretty much clean and dirt cheap, or I can buy Brave Bison, which I have done. I just don't really know why I would want to look at this when there's better options, which are simpler and well, just better businesses, I think. So again, not really of any interest to me, but good luck to Nigel, was it, who holds them?
I'm with you. It's in the being honest, also the whole marketing sector, I'm just very cautious on it at the moment with all of AI, because it gets changed through from the algorithms and how those search engines and also answer engines work, and it's pretty tough. And I think if you've got a really strong discipline within it, like sports and entertainment seems to be doing well. I think the issues business in Saatchi is doing okay. Brave Bison's obviously mini MBA is doing excellently. Yes. So there are pockets are still doing very well. And I think System One is also turning around from first half.
Yeah, it seems to be.
Half,
yeah.
Which, so you're definitely good. But overall, I think you just got to look at Publicis. You've just got to, you know, WPP. And then there's this Denso. They're all saying the same. Marketing, digital marketing is hard. It's hard graft at the moment as a total addressable market.
Yeah, I agree with that completely. I wouldn't touch WPP or S4 Capital. I mean, they both, you know, look so optically cheap. But as you say, I think they're withering on the vine, really. But I think for me, the small specialist type businesses like Brave Bison, ADVT, and well, that's more software now, isn't it? And Saatchi's, those are all saying the same sort of thing. They're saying AI, yes, it's brilliant. Yes, it can cut out loads and loads of manual work, blah, blah, blah. But you can't replace that human judgment. And we're hearing this left, right, and center on AI. And I think that's a key point.
Yeah. Good. Okay, let's go. We've got David Raywood is asking about sort of scientific instrumentation business, Renishaw. I think he owns it, and the shares have done remarkably well, actually, over the last year. They've gone from about a low of 24 quid, nearly double. They're at 47 now.
Oh,
any quick thoughts on this one? It's been, we haven't talked about it for a long time, but clearly somebody's... he's doing very well out of it.
Yeah, we cover it when it puts out, you know, just with a brief sort of comment when it puts out results. We've always been amber on it now for 18 months, just 3 out of 5. Good company. Yeah, making 3-year highs. This is our most recent notes on the 6th of May. P is the issue for us. Over 27 times it was back then in May. That was when it was £51 a share. So you've got the key question is, isn't it? Yes, it's a really good company, but can you justify the valuation? That is the balance sheet's nice and solid, no debt, bit of net cash. So, I mean, it does look a very good company. Strong demand in semiconductor and electronics manufacturing equipment and aerospace and defense. It said that in April. So looks like it's getting some big sector tailwinds, doesn't it? So, yeah, it looks a nice business to me, but I don't really feel qualified to give anything other than just a general overview there on the numbers.
Yeah, I mean, it's not dissimilar, actually, to the share price of Oxford Instruments, another sort of like instrumentation business has done very well. And I know there's been quite a few people who have been speculating about whether Oxford Instruments is going to get taken out. And I think you could probably do the same with Renishaw, because Spectris got taken out, you know, long ago by one of the big private equity guys. So I think that's what's happening, is that there's a lot of thought that somebody like, you know, like Apollo, Bain, Apex, anybody like these big Carlyle, these kind of guys who do the buy and build of unique trophy assets in the UK, they're prepared to pay 30 times PE for these types of. So I think, I mean, unless I haven't looked at the trading, unless it's going gangbuster, I suspect that's what's happening, is that people think, right, this one looks a global trophy asset that is definitely in the crosshairs of somebody.
Yeah, it's a great point you make, that, you know, we're very much in a strange situation where the public market in the UK is short-sighted, looks at current earnings, isn't prepared to pay up for future potential and growth as much as the private markets are. They're just prepared to pay far more, and this is why we're getting all these takeover bids, isn't it?
Yeah. Good. Just the last couple of ones. We've got WMin13. He's asking about water intelligence. I know I own it. Basically, these do end-to-end preventative maintenance for water leaks out in the States, but they've also got a business in Ireland, Australia, and the UK. And I think in the UK, it's to help things like stormwater going in sewage, going into reservoirs, okay, with a couple of blocks. And in the States, they've now very much sort of like teamed up with remote IoT devices that allow them to have a full end-to-end service. So you can almost tell the household when you're going to get a leak. Not quite, but they do the whole service. Shares have been on the floor over, well, just over a year, bottomed out about 220. Now just been picking up. He says on to about £3.07.
Yeah, we flagged this actually to our readers on the 18th of June. We moved it up from amber to amber green when it was £2.55. So we caught that bottom there and flagged it to our readers that things were improving. And what we flagged in particular was a good strong results for calendar 25. Very late though, putting them out on the 18th of June. So I think they're a bit sloppy with their reporting. Very low PE of only 8.4 times at the moment. That will have gone up to about 10 because of the share price rise. And inline results, good Q1 momentum, it mentioned, on track to be. So, yeah, look really good value back on when we looked at it on 18th of June. And it's up 20% since then. So, yeah, quite weak balance sheet is probably the only negative we've got on it, but not dangerously weak. Little bit of a slightly weird company. I can't put my finger on it, but... owner managed, and there's some sort of cross shareholding or something. I don't know. It's got a slight whiff of about it, but it does look good value. I can't disagree with that.
Yeah, I've been obviously owned for about 3 or 4 years, etc. I mean, they made a couple of changes. They've brought this new guy Will Nell in to run their US business, who's doing a terrific job in terms of industrializing their whole processes and centers there. Likewise, they've just recruited a new CFO to basically improve all the financial reporting. And I don't know.
Well, that's good news. Sorry,
it is. Yeah. So that's great. So there's been a lot, and that, you know, that's starting to. He hasn't shown yet through on the numbers, but it's certainly shown through on the actual business itself in terms of, you know, basically setting up for growth. And then in terms of the actual numbers, we should hopefully see an uptick in performance in the second half. So I'm quite optimistic, actually. And I know the shares have been rising on low volume of recently. So it's not something you can hang your hat on. But I actually think we're reaching a bit of a moment of truth here. And if they do, they have been winning good contracts with a lot of other businesses, like, you know, landlords and people developing properties who want a full end-to-end service for leak prevention. And if that then really starts motoring, which I think has got a good chance, then we should start seeing that, particularly in Q3, Q4, and next year. And you know, the brokers are forecasting sort of like high single digits, low double digit type growth, but you'll start seeing that operating leverage coming through. So I'm hopeful for next year that this has happened, but it has been a slow burn. But I'm really pleased that they've made the management changes and they're starting to industrialize all of those processes. And as I say, I think this Will Nell and Michael Moulton, who's the new CFO, are doing a terrific job. So let's wait and see.
Yeah, I mean, I think the numbers do look attractive value for sure. One thing I just remembered while you were talking was I did look, one of my readers flagged that they were not happy with the cash flows at Water Intelligence, and I did look at them and I had to agree. I think the cash flow statements don't look great. It's not a naturally strongly cash generative business at all. So I would flag that to people to check out for yourselves. Yeah. So cash flow statement is important there.
Yeah. I did check the cash flow statement actually, and it is cash generative. Yeah, before essentially what the investments they've been making, the CapEx and buying out the franchisees.
Oh, okay.
So they do it basically for organic growth and acquisition growth. That's where effectively they're reinvesting the actual own business. So no, it is cash generative. It's just it depends on what line you look at it.
That's right.
They're using every dollar that they generate to either buy companies or to invest in their own business.
They've bought back, I think, quite a few franchises, haven't they, over the years?
Yeah, that's good. Okay, final. We've got somebody was asking about MedPal, which is a small sort of digital pharmacy business. Yes. Oh, yeah, Frank was asking about it. Any quick thoughts on this? It was run by Jason Drummond.
He's had a mixed track record, hasn't he? But you know, an entrepreneur. I think it's too early stage. They're doing online pharmacy, aren't they, basically? And obviously the big exciting growth area is the weight loss jabs, which but there's so much competition. You know, you only have to search for buy weight loss jabs and you'll get, you know, there are hundreds of these things, literally. So I don't really see what its USP is. There's another listed company actually called Vulcan 2, which is doing the similar sort of thing, but on a bigger scale. So I think, you know, good luck to them. They've just done a £5 million placing a week ago, actually, MedPal did, but 13% discount. Okay, that's not too bad, actually, for this real nanocap end of the market. I mean, good luck to them. I hope it works. They're hoping to capture the market or a share of the market in the new Wegovy pills, which of course are going to be much more popular than having to give yourself injections. But you see that anyone and his dog is on this, all over this sector. I just don't see what USP they've got. So for me, I definitely wouldn't get involved. And I think the market cap's too high for just a speculative nanocap startup, really. So good luck to everyone involved. But for me as a value investor, primarily, it's too early stage.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I think it's classic risk or reward, isn't it, really? It's in a growing market, but you're right, there's competitions and how big are the barriers to entry into that in terms of regulatory approvals and all this sort of stuff. But it'll be certainly interesting and exciting story to watch. Okay, great. Well, thanks very much, everyone, for your questions. We've been going now for just over 80 minutes. And thanks again, Paul. And hopefully England will beat Norway on Saturday night. So.
Excellent. Thanks, Paul. Thanks. Very stimulating and enjoyable as always.
The Vox Markets Podcast. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.